All right. So this is Rebecca Hansen, and today in our Dialogues with the Experts, I'm interviewing Dr. Alan Weiss. Dr. Alan Weiss is one of those rare people who can say that he is a consultant, speaker, and author, and mean it. And I would like to add, Alan, that you are also a coach, a teacher, and a trainer. Alan's consulting firm, Summit Consulting Group, Inc., has attracted clients such as Merck, Hewlett-Packard, GE, Mercedes-Benz, and many other companies. He also serves on the board of directors for a Tony Award-winning New England Regional Theater, Festival Ballet, and the Newport International Film Festival. Dr. Weiss holds the record for selling out the highest-priced workshop on entrepreneurialism in the 21-year history of New York City's Learning Annex. His PhD is in psychology, and he's a member of the American Psychological Society, the American Counseling Association, and many other associations. In 2006, he was inducted into the Professional Speaking Hall of Fame. And Dr. Weiss is a professional and prolific publisher, which includes over 500 articles, 32 books, including his bestseller, Million Dollar Consulting, and his latest book, The Global Consultant. You know, Alan, I could just fill this whole hour reading about your accomplishments.
Well, I could listen to you forever, Rebecca.
Well, it is pretty astonishing what you have done with your life, and I must say to our listeners that we feel deeply honored to have you here with us today because you are a man who walks his talk. You don't just tell people what to do, but you actually live it as well.
That's very kind of you. I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you, Alan. So today, for the topic, I'd like us to discuss, if we can, change. Change is happening. It's happening all around us. Some changes we like, usually those that we've instigated ourselves, and some changes seem to just blindside us. So I've asked Alan today if he would come and speak to us on the topic of mastering change, the seven keys to a world that will never be the same. And so if our listeners would like to grab pencil and pen right now, you are going to be taking a lot of notes as we dialogue with Alan on this most important topic. Alan, so you're so welcome here, and we're just glad to have you. And you must be noticing the change that's happening.
Well, there, hard to miss. And I just let me say to begin that it's sort of a bromide that people are afraid of change. I haven't found that to be true. I think that change is embraced by people. You know, if you have a flat tire, you find another way to get to work. If there's a new development in your life, you find a way to deal with it. And usually the changes that are presented to people paint some rosy picture of the future. I think that what bothers people isn't so much the change, but the journey. And it's tough for people to undertake the exact route with any comfort to achieve that new future, and that's where we can best help people. So there are changes all around us, and they're going to proliferate. We're going to see more and more, and you know, that's simply the new reality.
Yes, it is. I was once told that if I didn't like so much change happening, that I should become a little more proactive and instigate some more change. I thought that was wonderful advice, because I did. I began to look around at different areas of my life that weren't working as well as I would have liked them. And so I began to institute change. And I think that's the kind of person you are, Alan. You're very proactive, very aware of your environment, very aware of your business, aware of your goals. And you're not afraid to institute change.
Well, no, I'm not. I think you have to constantly reinvent yourself, constantly raise the bar. And what you said a couple of times now is true, and that is when you instigate change, you're more comfortable with it because you have a sense of control. You have a sense of influence. When someone else inflicts change on you, although you can cope with it, there's a little less security because it's someone else's vision of the future.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening right now? I noticed one of your keys that you graciously sent to me is that there's a generational transition in leadership. What exactly are you seeing in that statement?
Well, what's happening is kind of interesting. You know, I don't like to label people, and I don't particularly enjoy this whole bit about boomers and Gen X and Gen Y and the greatest generation, because people are individuals, and you really can't slap a broad label and paint with a broad brush in terms of a generation of people. However, what you do see in the workplace is this, an older generation of leaders, that is people who are now in their late 50s and 60s, who are leaving. They're leaving from due to retirement. They're leaving because they're often being replaced with less expensive alternatives. They're leaving because they've had it. A whole raft of reasons. But these are people who largely did not grow up with technology, had it inflicted on them in the workplace, and have had the experience of managing through good times and bad prior to this latest economic turmoil. So their tenure was such, it was long enough, that they had the variety and experience of all kinds of economic times while they were in positions of executive influence and senior management. Mm-hmm. They're being replaced by people in their 40s and early 50s who grew up with technology and are early adapters, by and large, of technology, which makes a huge difference. But on the other hand, prior to this recession, prior to this latest market problem over the last year, had never had to really manage through tough times. They weren't in a position of power during tough times, and the times weren't all that tough while they were growing up in business. There were some minor tweaks, but nothing seriously wrong. And so consequently, this generational transition is going to be interesting because on the one hand, you have people much more adept at using modern technology, globalization, instant communication, and so forth. But on the other hand, not the same wealth and breadth of experience in terms of managing in all kinds of different times. So I think we're going to see some interesting and sometimes profound shifts in how large organizations are run, what their philosophies are, how they adapt, how resilient they are, and so forth.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm one of those forward thinkers. I love to imagine what could happen if the leadership, if the old school leadership is being replaced by sort of younger energy, broad-minded, more technologically minded people. But you did bring up a good point there, is that most of the people in their 40s or 50s have yet to face a really severe challenge in their life, something that is like bread and butter threatening or a life and death threatening. We hate to wish anything like that upon people, but there is a certain resilience that develops in your own persona and your own way of being when you have come through some of that. Do you have a recommendation for the younger folks?
Well, my recommendation is to extend your experiences. You know, that you, when you, I think this is still true, but I remember when I was working with GE as a consultant, by the time you were in your mid-40s, you had to expect to have an overseas assignment because GE insisted that its senior management had experience internationally. And consequently, you were looking for that assignment. If you wanted to get ahead in GE, that's what happened. By the time you got into your 50s, it was too late, and so you were not going to make any kind of senior position. And I would advise that sort of GE philosophy today, which is maximize your experiences, maximize your work in a variety of different ways with a variety of different challenges, and maximize the various input you have from the organization. So try to work at least briefly, you know, in sales, in manufacturing or in customer service or in R&D or in whatever it is. I tell people all the time that no one should have a career in human resources. It's one of the most wasteful things you can do. you know, get line experience or key staff experience in a variety of different ways so that you're not in a position of learning on the job when you're in an executive position. I mean, one of the things that none of us wants, I mean, critiques of President Obama, I mean, correctly or incorrectly, I'm not taking a position here on it, but one of the critiques is that he would be learning on the job because he had such little background, you know, just a couple of years in the United States Senate. Mm-hmm. Would he have to be learning on the job? Nobody wants that. Well, the same thing. Nobody wants a senior executive in private enterprise or in nonprofits or in education to be learning on the job. They'd like you to come in with enough experience and knowledge so that you can handle almost anything that you're dealt.
Oh, that's a wonderful goal to have. And I know of some a young couple right now who plan to move to a different part of the world. They're going to go over to India so that they can gain experience. They've been IT professionals in the United States, and they both recognize that their experience has been rather narrow. And so they're doing this in order to have the experience of trying to implement some of their skills and business acuity in a foreign country. That would be a marvelous experience, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
Exactly. All right. Excellent. And so what else is important here? What's another key to mastering this change that is upon us, ready or not? But what's another key that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Well, I think that we're seeing more and more of what I call just-in-time knowledge, and that is knowledge has to be, and I'm not talking about data or information, I'm talking about knowledge has to be available for a person who wants to use it at just the right time. And the key here is exchanging implicit information for explicit information and vice versa, and I'll tell you what I mean. A lot of people who work in organizational life have a great deal of implicit knowledge. That is, they know instinctually what they should do with a customer complaint or a request from the field or any kind of particular challenge.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing, though, is to make that implicit knowledge explicit so that their colleagues know it. So I know it's in your head and you know it's in my head.
Yes.
So that we maximize this individual implicit knowledge that we've attained so that we can make each other more effective. Now, the opposite of that is to make the explicit knowledge, which is the knowledge the company or the organization or the structure has, which they embody in manuals and procedures and so on, to make that implicit so that I don't have to go through a tutorial, I don't have to look things up, but I can access it because I've internalized it. So in the first part, we're taking personalized knowledge and institutionalizing it. And in the second part, we're taking institutional knowledge and personalizing it. And the more we do that, the more we can get to the position of what I call just-in-time knowledge. And just as just-in-time manufacturing makes the best of reducing inventory costs and manufacturing costs and so forth, this makes the best of reducing the cost of delivering knowledge and delivering wisdom. There was a book about this 10 years or so ago called by two Japanese authors whose names I can neither remember nor pronounce, but it's, I think it was called The Knowledge-Producing Company. And it's a very tough read, but essentially what they talk about is this this need to exchange personal and institutional knowledge so that it's easily accessible to improve productivity.
So I can see where this is really timely for this generation, no matter what your age is. But with the Internet, with the advent of the Internet, there was such a connection to information, and a hunger, I believe, was created. I know I experienced this huge hunger to attain information and knowledge and that. And because what was on the Internet, even in the earliest days of it becoming public, what was on the Internet was primarily university-based and educational. It was just like, you know, a feast to be able to go into the Internet and access this information. And so today, though, I think one of the slower-moving institutions, if I can just say it like that, is the educational institutions. They have been very slow at fully embracing ways to deliver more cost-effectively information, knowledge, degrees, a bachelor's or a master's degree. Some of them have, but overall, that's been one of the slower moving, maybe dinosaurs, because pretty soon they're going to price it right out of everybody's pocket to be able to go to university, and that's already happening here in Canada, where I'm located. So this knowledge production, the ability to produce what you know innately or intuitively, or what you've been able to assimilate inside your own life and your own business, to be able to deliver that to people very quickly, rapidly, accurately, and affordably, I think is another key factor in there. Alan, you've done that very, very nicely with your business. Your information is very accessible, and you've kept right up there and abreast with what young people like.
Well, I think if you can create channels where people can access information, get questions answered quickly, that's the key to the future. Next year, we're going to come out with something called Alan and the Gang, where people can come and access text, audio, video, all kinds of things based on the questions and interests they have. And then they can actually ask questions to the gang or to me on a global basis 24/7. And I think that's going to be the future of this just-in-time learning I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you, Alan. And I'm looking at the same globalization for the Law of Attraction Training Center, and looking at ways in which we can offer the same kind of thing, maybe not quite as sophisticated as your system is, but I will be looking at your system to see how you do this as we go into other countries with the Law of Attraction programs as well.
Makes sense.
So I'm interested in this globalization of the knowledge business. I mean, obviously, there to have many portals or many avenues or many types of ways that people can access this knowledge base that you have. What else do you see in the globalization part?
Well, Peter Drucker used to write about the fact that knowledge was a tremendous export item. And in the United States, where he lived and worked, he talked about the fact that if you calculated in exported knowledge, the United States wouldn't have a trade deficit. And he used two things, the management expertise that went abroad and the foreign students who came to U.S. universities to learn. And I think just as, you know, right now, I called United Parcel Service yesterday to see if they could deliver a very expensive item and if they could insure it. And I realized immediately that my phone call had been picked up by someone in India. Now, unfortunately, somebody in India trying to reply to you about local routes and deliveries between Rhode Island and New York is just plain silly. Mm-hmm. And so that's done purely as a cost-cutting basis. But on the other hand, if my question had been about something else, and as so commonly is the case with India or Korea or the Philippines or wherever, a technical question, it wouldn't have made much of a difference. And so the globalization of the knowledge business comes about for several reasons. One is that technology now allows people to do this easily and at virtually no cost. The second is it permits for a round-the-clock kind of accessibility. The third is that, like it or not, I'm not making any kind of value judgments here, but English, American English in particular, is the universal language right now.
Yeah.
Fourth, the dollar is the universal currency, and despite its woes at times, it will always be the universal currency. It's not about to be replaced by the euro or the Thai baht or anything else. And so, consequently, you have this marvelous sort of consistency and universality taking place, which, while it might have some drawbacks culturally and might have some people a little bit bent out of shape, the fact is it enables people anywhere in the world to access expertise anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll get to a point where we'll find that a certain kind of expertise might reside in a Chinese management institute, or in an Argentinian research center, or in an Australian consulting operation. And we'll be able to access that as we see fit, when we see fit, by voice, by email, by video. Skype, for example, is just the beginning of these kinds of things. And so if you factor in that we have increasingly burgeoning economies in places like Brazil and India and China. We have residual superb economies and thinking in places like North America and Western Europe. You begin to see that if we can readily access all of this at any given time, it puts us in a position of furthering our businesses and our personal lives tremendously because we've cut out the waiting time. We've cut out the middleman. We've cut out doubts about who we should be talking to, because the one thing that the Internet does is it allows us to pinpoint where the expertise is.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is the Internet is really the ultimate repository of quality content. And so if you're a left-handed fly fisherman, you can go on the Internet and find a place that sells only left-handed fly fishing equipment. It's that particular. You know, it's that kind of dedicated quality content. And that's what we'll be able to do with knowledge all over the world.
Oh, I'm getting excited, Alan.
Oh, good.
This is an area that's very near and dear to my heart because long before the internet hit the part of Canada that I lived in, and you have to remember that Canada is generally 5 to 10 years behind the United States when it comes to implementing technology. So long before it hit the part of Canada that I lived in, I had this deep, deep longing to be connected on a global scale. And because of my business, because I'm delivering knowledge-based information at the Law of Attraction Training Center, I am now able to do this. So that's why I'm getting excited.
Dear.
I really like it. All right. So I'm really interested in your next point, though. This will be point number four. I'm just going to generalize the first three points for people who are taking notes. The first one was the general transition in leadership. The second is what Alan's calling just-in-time knowledge. And I liked your description of the implicit and explicit transfer of information, that it needs to be happening both ways. The third point was the globalization of the knowledge business. And this fourth one has to do with social platforms. I have to tell you, Alan, I have a personal resistance to going there with you. So maybe what you're sharing with me today will kind of loosen up some of my own resistance. So it says rationalization of social platforms. What does that mean?
Well, I've been very critical of the social platforms of LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter and so on. And so, of course, I joined them all because you really shouldn't critique anything unless you're part of it and understand it. And right now I've got about 1,350 followers on Twitter and, I don't know, 5 million people on LinkedIn or whatever that is and you know, 400 friends on Facebook. And I found that while these are great for keeping in touch with people, and they're great for, you know, looking for jobs or helping people with jobs, if you look at corporate consulting, that is consultants whose target audience is corporate entities, this is not a place to market. And if you look at most of the people who are voraciously promoting the social platforms, mm-hmm. they're people who have something to gain by it. And they're people who coach other people on how to use the platforms. I mean, they're not really successful outside of that. And so
yes.
It's a very incestuous thing. But the social media platforms are popular because they give people airtime. People talk about their babies. They talk about their latest accomplishment. They talk about a good restaurant they went to. And even though it might bore 98% of everybody reading it, it pleases them. It's the difference between, you know, would you like to see my vacation slides or may I see your vacation slides? You know, you
right.
want to show people your vacation slides. So... but if you look at this popularity, and don't forget, you know, as we talk today, Twitter is not profitable. Twitter, it has no way to make money, really. And they value the company at billions and billions of dollars, but right now it doesn't even have advertising. I mean, there's no way to make money. So what's going to happen here? I think that this combination of the social platforms, I mean, they all work on a slightly different basis. And there are others I'm not even mentioning because I'm not familiar
mm-hmm.
with them. What you'll find, though, is they will be rationalized so that there'll be different channels wherein people who are really out to create business linkages, business contacts of various kinds, there'll be a certain way for them to do that, where it's not mixed up with these stupid tests like what animal do you resemble and what part of your body are you most familiar with, you know, these
yeah.
dumb tests on Facebook, which are, you know, beyond stupidity. Similarly, for people who just want to shoot the breeze and be social and in effect be part of a flea market or a cocktail party, which is what these things are socially, there'll be ample opportunity for them to do that. For other groups who want to form some kind of association of like-minded professionals or like-minded hobbyists or whatever, traditionally, then you can do it now. And so I think that the power of the social platforms will be that people can, at virtually no cost, join up on them and create their own private agendas, their own personal agendas, without having to be subject to the great cacophony, the great noise all around them. You know, what happened with radio when it was first developed is that it wasn't very popular until radio formed networks. And then you could hear the same program in Los Angeles and Toronto and New York. And then radio became popular. When television came out, there were very few television televisions being purchased and very few shows because it was such a singular experience. But then they formed television networks. And in San Francisco and Chicago and Miami, you could watch the same show. And then television took off. What we're now seeing with newspapers is as newspapers are failing all over the world because of stupid management, we see newspaper networks. For example, in the United States, there are three large newspaper networks.
Yes.
There's the New York Times, there's the Wall Street Journal, and there's USA Today. And many big city newspapers are folding, and the community newspapers are holding up. But major newspapers are folding. And what will happen in the United States, and probably around the world, is that if you live in Denver, you will get the Denver edition of the New York Times, just as you do today, really, but it will be even more formalized. And so there'll be newspaper networks. Now, going back to the social media, I think what you'll find are social media networks. And they'll operate the same way, same thing around the globe, for like-minded people in certain ways. And so there might be, you know, if we kept the current names, there might be a Facebook A, Facebook B, Facebook C, although I think they're going to probably combine somewhat, and you'll have, you know, social network one, business network two, a hobby network three, and I think that's what we're going to be seeing, so that people don't have to wade through all the noise and all the irrelevancies to use these things to their maximum benefit for any individual.
Well, that's hopeful. That gives me a hopeful outlook, because, frankly, I don't have time to sit at the computer and Twitter away, you know, and tell everybody about my day or what I had to eat or taking my daughter, you know, to the doctor or whatever. I don't have time to talk about those things. I really don't, but I welcome several business-related social networking groups, because I recognize that we can form business alliances this way. So I've dropped off of a lot of the more social ones, but I've kept myself on a few key business networks. But I haven't really spent a lot of energy in developing those. So thank you, Alan. That could just really open up that possibility for me. It does open it up for me.
That makes sense to you.
This is exciting. I can see, and I hope our listeners are able to do this as well. But I can see how I am finding a niche or a niche for myself in what you're saying. I love that you have such a big picture, and that it really is inclusive of anyone who wants to be successful in their business or entrepreneurship. And I like the broad strokes that you're painting for us today.
Good.
What's this next point? Transient talent? What does that imply?
Well, the old traditional organization is really pretty much finished. And what we've seen through the downsizings that took place even before this latest economic turmoil, and certainly what we're seeing during and after as we're emerging, is that corporations are now lean and mean, and the residual talent that used to be there is not. So, for example, for outside consultants, this is a boom because there is no more internal competition. By and large, internal consulting and internal transformational kinds of talent has been let go. And just like recruiting and compensation and other things have been outsourced, a lot more is going to be outsourced. And I think what's coming, though, is a slight change in what will happen is this. You'll have in organizations executives who are responsible for strategy and major decision-making, and then there'll be a layer under them who are responsible for implementation. And these will largely be talent wranglers, and they will go out and procure talent. Now, the organization might have some residual talent if it finds itself constantly involved with the same kinds of projects or manufacturing or equipment or whatever, but largely as their projects change, as their clients change, as their customers change, they will go outside through these talent wranglers, these talent acquirers, and get the talent they need on an ad hoc basis and a temporary basis. And so if there's a let's just say that somebody gets a 9-month project from Boeing Aircraft, people will go out and they'll obtain the talent they need to fulfill that for those 9 months, and then that talent will be let go again. If the next challenge or the next project is from a completely different kind of company, they'll similarly go out and get the talent that's commensurate with that kind of work, and then they'll let them go. So the talent will be on board for 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or even 2 years, but then we'll go again. It won't be a permanent arrangement. And so the talent will come along and name its own price. There'll be some negotiating with the talent acquirers. They'll have their benefits packages on their backs, like a backpack. Mm-hmm. And the company will not be in the expensive position of providing fringe benefits and health care and retirement. People will be bringing their own. They'll be funding their own retirement plans. They'll be funding their own health care and so forth and so on. And people will actually move from job to job. They'll move from project to project, from company to company, sometimes staying as little as a month, sometimes staying for as long as a few years. But you're going to see more and more of that kind of transient talent. It's cheaper for the employer, and it's actually more control and less threat for the worker. It's so long as they can accommodate the need for benefits and health coverage and things like that, I think that's where we see things going. And we're already seeing, of course, organizations that are far leaner versions of themselves than ever before.
And this is good to hear for people who have maybe been outsourced or just they're totally out of a job right now. The old mindset of you get a job and you keep it for 20, 25 years and then you retire, that just isn't even on the table anymore.
No, it's not even on the table in Japan, for example, where that was the most singular hallmark of Japanese society. You worked at one place forever. You were a salaryman. And even in Japan, that's no longer the case. So it's certainly not the case in the United States or in Canada or in Western Europe, with the exception of some places where the labor and union laws are tough. But if you look at those places, Germany would be an example. You have very low productivity.
Yeah.
Right now, the American worker has among the highest productivity in the world. And in the third quarter, just this past quarter this year, American worker productivity skyrocketed. It went up by a huge amount. So we'll see more and more of that.
Well, that's excellent. If a person can embrace this new way of being a worker or a consultant or whatever by means of promoting themselves, so the willingness to learn how to promote yourself, how to put yourself out there, how to accept short-term contracts, how to negotiate, all of these are skills that probably people in the 40 to 60 age range may not have acquired along their educational path. So, Alan, I think what you offer, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what you offer through Summit Consulting, Inc., is the kind of training that people are going to need to be able to show their skills, you know, put their skills forward, put their very best foot forward, be comfortable with shorter-term contracts, be comfortable with the management of that kind of a business. Is that what you're offering?
Well, we help people to become more entrepreneurial. We help people to get over their self-esteem issues. We help people to acquire skills so that they present a more powerful resource.
Yeah.
And I think the people who don't take this on, people who don't accept that this is the way things are going and resist it, had better get used to being out of a job because it's going to be harder and harder to get traditional long-term work.
Very important. That's a very key thing. I'm sure that some people who will be listening to this dialogue that we're having, Alan, are people who are facing either they've just been laid off or they've been off for a while and they're really feeling like, I just don't fit anymore, or how do I fit, or where do I fit? And so you're giving us some really good nuggets to hold on to here. The development of self-esteem, the development of your own, the worth of what it is you bring to the table, the way to present yourself in a professional and polished way. Companies don't want to have to be the ones to put the finish on you. They want you to come polished and finished. And so for an individual to get the rough edges, knocked off, as it were, and to be able to present themselves in a clear, concise, and polished professional way, that's going to be extremely important. If they have a choice between somebody who's in, running shoes and baggy pants and a loose T-shirt, or someone who has taken the time to be groomed properly and present themselves as a professional, you know which one is going to be more likely to be hired. So all of these things come into play. They all factor in. And I think sometimes when we're in a situation that's a bit of a crisis, we forget that it's more than just I've lost my job or I've been laid off. It's how do you come across to people? How do you present yourself? And how do you package what you do in a way that today's world is looking for you? So good job. I'm glad you do this, Alan. It's fabulous. Well, we're doing good on time here. This is such a big topic. And I see that you have two more points, but I want to be able to really look in at this self-perpetuating communities. What are you talking about, self-perpetuating communities? That's point number six here.
Well, I call this REV, R-E-V, which stands for Reciprocating Exponential Value. And what I'm talking about is this. If you think of the iPhone, the iPhone was created, and then people started to create applications for it. They call apps. And as they created apps, it drew more and more people to the iPhone who found the apps very important rather than the iPhone itself. But the apps were important, so they bought the iPhone and bought the apps. And then that spurred Apple to make still a better iPhone. And right now, the one I have is, the third generation of iPhone. And right now, the last time I looked, about 2 months ago, there were 65,000 apps. Right now, there are 100,000 apps for the iPhone. I mean, the next nearest competitor, I think, has something like 8,500, but it's not close, whatever it is. 100,000 apps for the iPhone. So as the iPhone attracted people creating applications, which attracted people, which attracted them to make more applications, which attracted Apple to make a better iPhone and so forth, you have this self-perpetuating community, and it gets ferociously bigger and bigger. And the iPhone is one of the most dramatic consumer product introductions, in our lifetime, really. So if you look at this now in terms of communities, what I do is I build communities. And so I have a mentor program. I have a Society for the Advancement of Consulting. I have a Million Dollar Club. I have people who have been in my workshops. I have five or six or eight different kinds of communities which overlap and interact with each other. And as these communities draw people of talent and value and accomplishment, more people are drawn to them. And so the people start drawing other people to them. I start enlarging the community. I introduce new value. More and more people want to join. And so these communities become self-reinforcing and self-perpetuating. One of my communities is alansforums.com, which is a private chat room, and that is, if you're in one of my communities, you get in for free. If you're not, you have to pay to get in. So it's not like Facebook or someone's blog.
Right.
24 hours a day, people are discussing on there ethics and marketing and sales and politics and all kinds of things. And it's attracted quite a high rate of successful people, which attracts still more people to it. But the interesting thing about these communities is, in Alan's Forums, for example, somebody will write in a question. They've got a question about a client they're dealing with, and seven or eight people will write responses, and it will go back and forth for a day or so. And I might never respond. In that particular thread, I might never intervene. But it's still to my credit. I still get the credit for the value of bringing people together, even though I might not have personally intervened. And so the power, the leverage that you have in these communities is that people interact, and they still give you credit even though your labor intensity is greatly reduced.
Mm-hmm.
Another advantage is you begin to control the conversation. So, for example, what the Internet did was it allowed customers to talk to each other for the first time in real time.
Right.
It was very difficult for customers to talk customer to customer before. You had to talk through the organization. But now you have people talking to each other. And so if they were unhappy with, let's say, Citibank, they'd put up a website that said CitibankSucks.com. And these would be all the complaints and all the resistance about Citibank. So Citibank and a lot of firms like it got smart, and they would put up a website, Citibank.com, and they would invite people to complain. They would invite people to post things that were good, bad, or otherwise. That way, not only could they monitor and keep their eye on what was being said about them so they could calibrate their performance, they could also squelch rumors and things that just weren't true by printing things they wanted to. And they got credit for hosting the place and providing that open forum rather than have a bunch of renegades do it down the street.
Yeah.
And so this is the value of having these self-perpetuating communities where people can talk directly to each other, but the organizer and the perpetrator still gets the credit for having them together. Now, I'll say one more thing here. I believe that traditional trade associations and professional associations will be replaced by these communities because, or they'll turn into these communities because no one anymore is willing to spend $200 or $500 or $1,500 a year on membership in a place that simply sends you a newsletter once a month, tries to sell you all kinds of products and services, and has a convention once a year that you have to travel to and spend money to feed yourself and find most of the speakers boring. Mm-hmm. However, if it becomes a true self-perpetuating community, this reciprocating value, then you're part of an interactive series of events and processes that take place as often as you wish to indulge, and you're getting value whenever you wish to try to derive it. That's the future of trade and professional organizations, and those that don't make that transfer to these communities are going to go out of business.
Amen to that. Yes. Wow, that's brilliant. That's just brilliant, Alan. I love what you're doing. I love how you're explaining it to us because that makes total sense to me. I'm all for working smarter and not harder. So that seems to me that you have found that these forums, which are by subscription or for people who are in the process of your program, is working to fulfill that need very beautifully. Wonderful. That's just brilliant. Okay, and now we come to point seven, which is the seventh of the keys. And I think this is a really large component for a lot of our audience, okay? And that is the personal and spiritual fulfillment and how important that is becoming and how more and more of North America is realizing that somehow they need to find meaningful work that brings in more than adequate income that is also personally and spiritually fulfilling.
Well, you know, 30 or 35 years ago, Nesbitt had it right in Megatrends. Very few of these prognosticators are right, and very few are ever held to be judged on the basis of their prognostications. But in Megatrends, Nesbitt said high tech, high touch, and he had it right. In fact, I can make a case that the social platforms we were talking about earlier are an attempt to fill in the high touch using technology, which is somewhat ironic. But people want to stay in touch with each other, and they use technology to do it. The high tech, high touch is very important because as the communities and as the societies get more complex and use increasing amounts of technology in replacement of human interaction, personalization is going to become more and more important, especially for people with high affiliation needs. I think what we're seeing is the need for people to be in touch more. We're seeing the need for people to interact more. And, you know, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy, the highest level in his hierarchy was the self-actualization. Now, Maslow's hierarchy has never, ever been validated in the workplace. It's a theory. It's never been proved. And my own experience is that people actually tend to bounce around among Maslow's hierarchy. It's not a strict sequence where you go from the bottom, you know, security needs and so on, onto the top. I think that people tend to bounce around, and one of the levels in there is affiliation and so on. And people need more and more of that. Part of that is going to come from interaction with others. Part of it's going to come from what I've called here spirituality. And I don't necessarily mean religion, although certainly religion is one method of expression for spirituality. But I think a lot of people are trying to get simply more in touch with themselves. They're trying to understand who they are and what they are, what their contribution is to the environment, how do they make the best of their life, how should they be contributing to others, and so forth and so on. And it's no longer a taboo topic. It's no longer a topic that, you know, 10 years ago people would have said that doesn't belong in the workplace or they would have sued you for speaking of it. And so there's a real attempt to try to determine what one's place is in terms of your life, in terms of your business, and in terms of the surrounding community. And so you're going to, as people grapple with this, I think that they're going to get help from coaches, they're going to get help from the organization itself, they're going to get help from their colleagues, because the happier you are, the more content you are, the better you perform at work. And all of the studies I've ever seen show that money is not a motivator, but gratification from the work is a motivator. Moreover, people don't leave businesses. People leave people. And so in any company, if you see a high dropout rate, you see a high attrition rate, outside of a company in trouble and going bankrupt, but a healthy company, they're usually leaving certain bosses. They're usually leaving certain managers. And so the fulfillment isn't there, and you either have to get this fulfillment from the gratification from the work or from an inner wellspring, of your own well-being. And so it behooves the company to help people get to that position, mm-hmm. and certainly it's reasonable for people to expect it and try to achieve it. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that, not this empty-headed motivational mush that you hear, not walking over hot coals, but a real exploration of who we are and what roles we're playing and why it's important.
Exactly. And I just see so many people who gravitate toward the law of attraction they seem to have an overriding desire to understand their purpose in this life. It's like they've been rudderless, but okay with being rudderless for a long time. And then all of a sudden, too many of the outer circumstances fall apart, and suddenly they're thrust into this big, big question. What is my purpose? What am I here for? What's my destiny? What am I destined to do? Or what would bring fulfillment to my life? There may be too much emphasis on it. However, it's probably going to self-correct. We usually go from one extreme to the other, and then it comes back somewhere in the middle where you find that fulfillment. I think as long as you honor what your values are and you honor other people, that you can feel like you're contributing to society and develop a sense of fulfillment. It doesn't have to be some great big zap of lightning or a bolt of lightning that hits you that suddenly you see, oh, I'm destined to do this, or my purpose is to be a great such and such. It's really to find that feeling of fulfillment through whatever it is you're good at doing and to recognize how you may be helping other people through giving your gifts and talents. And so I just see this sort of swing a little bit far over to the spirituality part, although it's very important, and we really major on it at Law of Attraction Training Center. But there's got to be a balance by the practical and the day-to-day. A lot of what's pushed as Law of Attraction out there, if I can just kind of diverse here for a second, some people grasp onto it as a means of easily having a living, making money, without having to do anything other than think about what they want. And I know that isn't going to cut it. It's one thing to have a vision of yourself, a goal, a purpose out there, and we need to have that, but it's also that willingness to do whatever it takes to get me from here to there. I mean, that's what I'm doing. I work every day. I don't just sit back and meditate all day long. I do the work. And as we're willing to do the work, then we're guided, and we have these opportunities like we're having today with you, Alan. And it's just, it's wonderful. The balance is what we need to see here between our personal fulfillment, spiritual fulfillment, and being able to help others in our community, whether it's through the internet or in our physical location like you're doing with the arts there. To bring that balance back into our lives. Anything else you want to add to this wonderful list? It's a very full meal, Alan.
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of things we can talk about, but, you asked me to isolate some, so I just chose those seven. And I think that, what we're doing is we're looking at right now the beginnings of a dramatic recovery. A lot of people said that the recovery wouldn't occur till 2012, 2011. Well, here it is 2009, and we're seeing tremendous signs of the recovery. And we're going to see that continue rather dramatically. And I think a lot of people have learned lessons, which will make the economy even stronger. And while there'll always be some hiccups along the way, I think it's a great time to be an entrepreneur. It's a great time to be a consultant. It's a fabulous time to try to meet your personal objectives. And I think that 2010 holds a great deal of promise for everyone.
Amen to that. I'm seeing it too. Well, I want to thank you, Alan, for being our guest here today. It's been a real joy to interact with you, and I'm just so happy to do this.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
And I hope that we can do this again sometime, Alan, or maybe it'll be the other way around. Maybe you'll be interviewing me.
Fair enough.
Either way, it's a win-win situation. So thanks, everyone, and we'll see you all next time. All right. Thanks, Alan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.